This episode is sponsored by State Farm. You a small business owner looking for insurance that fits your needs and budget? Well, look no further than State Farm. State Farm agents are not just insurance providers. They're also small business owners who live and work right here in your community. They understand the unique challenges of running and protecting a small business. When it comes to small business insurance, State Farm knows what it takes. Create a plan that fits your needs and your budget. State Farm agents are ready to help you choose personalized policies that truly understand your business. Insure your small business with a fellow small business owner. Talk to a State Farm agent today and get started on personalized small business insurance that fits your needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today. Ready for an awesome episode? Well, so are we. But you know what? Before we get to it, I got to tell you that members of Navy Federal Credit Union could earn more and save more. Bam! Not all financial institutions offer you as many choices for savings options as our friends at Navy Federal do. Start your savings journey with a low minimum deposit. For example, you could open an Easy Start certificate for just $50. And then how many certificates do this? You can then add money at any time and watch your savings grow. To learn more, visit NavyFederal.org. At Navy Federal, our members are the mission. Navy Federal is insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Lender. Membership required. Terms and conditions apply. Loan subject to approval.
Look.
This is hot, Ray.
Symmetrical book stacking. Just like the Philadelphia Mass Turbulence of 1947.
You're right. No human being would stack books like this.
Listen. You smell something?
Live from Joe's mom's basement, it's the Stacking Benjamin Show. I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, and today you'll learn why passive index funds have clearly won the investing game with the president of Bonafide Wealth, Doug Bonaparte. Plus, it's the empress of the stacking universe, Crystal Hammond. And finally, the star of last year's film, Napoleon, it's Joaquin. Oh, never mind. It's a different guy in a funny hat. It's just Len Penzo. But that's not all. Halfway through the show, I'll share my short trivia question. And now, a guy who's not afraid to invade your ears with a small but determined army, it's the emperor of all things personal finance, Joe Saul-Sehy.
Hey, everybody, and happy weekend. We're so glad you're here. Sit back, relax, put your feet up, because we're about to have an hour of financial nerdery. Welcome to another episode of the Stacking Benjamin Show, brought to you on Fridays by State Farm. State Farm agents are small business owners, too, so they know how to help you choose personalized policies that fit your needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today. We're not just going to talk to our local agent. We're going to talk to the people at this roundtable because, man, do we have the Uber nerds with us today. We're going to have some super fun, but let's start off with my co-host on our sister show, the Stacky D Show, Crystal Hammond's here. How are you?
Great. How are you? So is a nerdery, I'll raise you a strategery. Is that how we're going to outword each other today?
Strategery and nerdery.
I would love to. And then, Lynn, is it cold in your house? You're making me hot. I think I need to turn on the fan.
Lynn makes everybody hot.
That's true. It's California. And once the temperature dips below 65 here, it's freezing. It's ice age out here. So
wow,
it's 64 right now.
Ice age. Heat. That's horrible. I feel so bad being from Michigan. 64, you must be. Oh, I can't imagine. And by the way, you had the squirrel cam. You sent us something from the squirrel cam. A little bit bigger than average squirrel on your squirrel cam, Len?
Yeah, well, it was squirrel cam after dark. So that was a possum. That's what I showed. Although Doug thought it was a grizzly bear, but you were close, Doug. Not quite.
Well, based on where that camera was set up, that thing was huge. I was terrified.
By the way, when you said squirrel cam after dark, it sounded like Len's only squirrels account. Like he's got this other thing going on.
That's a good idea. That's a really good idea. I might want to have to consider that.
Yeah. Squirrels Gone Wild is Len's next video.
Hey, real quick, you're talking about Uber nerds. I did send out for my IQ test and I got the results back.
Oh,
unfortunately, they were negative. Oh. So,
whoops. Hold on, wrong button. There it is. had to find it. Nice, nice job,
Len.
You know, I prepare every time we record, I have to brace myself. It's like doing a polar plunge for me. When Len starts to do his intro, I'm just sitting here gritting my teeth, just waiting, like, how bad is it going to be? It comes, like, oh, God, it was as bad as I thought.
I thought the delivery on that was quick and to the point, Doug. Mm-hmm. You've been chastising me about it.
Even the East German judge gave you a 7, Len, yeah, so you were good.
You. Thank you.
Yeah, so wondering what the hell he's doing. He's doing We have financial planner and big guy on X/Twitter, Doug Bonaparte, is here. How are you, man?
I'm good. Overwhelmed every day with life, but in the good way. We got kids running around and businesses being run. And, oh, you know, someone should have told me this is what knocking 40 was going to feel like.
Child. Youngin.
You guys remember that. You guys remember putting a 4 in front of
a long time ago.
He's been here 6 minutes and he already called us old guys, Len.
I know. And he did it with a smile, too.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
I saw, Doug, you rolling your eyes when you heard Len complaining about life in the 60s, because you're over there in the New York area. Slightly colder?
Little bit. Yeah, the 60s. I thought that wasn't a reference to his age. That was the temperature.
Oh. There it is again.
Yeah, I'm Florida man. I was lamenting about seasonal depression because it's cold and it's rainy and it's gray. And I just want, like, my whole day is set up by whether or not at this point, if the sky is blue. Like, I'm not even in, are we above or below 40 degrees? I'm like, is the sky blue? I'll take the dopamine that comes with a blue sky.
Well, today is a bright spot in your life, Doug, because you're here with us.
True. This is very true.
Of course.
When you reached out to say, hey, you want to come back on? I said no. I mean, I said yes. I would love nothing more than to join all of you and talk about my favorite subjects, personal finance.
Well, and then we sent you the contract. What do you think about the contract we sent you?
Well, the best part about that is
this episode is sponsored by State Farm. You, a small business owner looking for insurance that fits your needs and budget? Well, look no further than State Farm. State Farm agents are not just insurance providers. They're also small business owners who live and work right here in your community. They understand the unique challenges of running and protecting a small business. When it comes to small business insurance, State Farm knows what it takes. Create a plan that fits your needs and your budget. State Farm agents are ready to help you choose personalized policies that truly understand your business. Insure your small business with a fellow small business owner. Talk to a State Farm agent today and get started on personalized small business insurance that fits your needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today. But did you read the second addendum?
I have the lawyers take care of that. And by lawyers, I mean my wife.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You said your wife being the lawyer in the family. We had to stop you right there, Doug.
Yeah, so. You knew it was dangerous just to continue talking to me at that point.
Absolutely. Don't want to get the lawyers involved.
Yeah.
Doug Bonaparte joining us, Len Penzo, Crystal Hammond, neighbor Doug. We're going to talk about passive versus active investments and a big change in the market. So let's go. Our piece today, I first saw a few weeks ago in Morningstar, and this is written by John Reckenthaler. John writes, index funds have officially won. What is he talking about? Well, he says the inevitable has at last arrived. In January, for the first time, passively managed funds controlled more assets than did their actively managed competitors. This count includes both traditional mutual funds and exchange traded funds. The revolution occurred only gradually. August 1976, Vanguard introduced the first publicly available index fund. Wells Fargo, by the way, had already beaten them to the punch. We actually did a whole story on this previously that we'll link to in the show notes page. But in the story, by the way, is pretty funny. I don't know if you guys know this, but John Bogle actually wrote a white paper that said that he thought index funds and passively managed investing was a stunt that nobody should do. And then he became the grandfather of index investing once he figured out that he could make some money, maybe changing that opinion. But not only has he long since thought that passive investing is a great idea, but so have apparently investors. So Crystal, let's start with you. Do you pay a lot of attention to active versus passive funds in your investment? Because really on this panel, you represent, I guess, the every woman, right? You're not doing this professionally like Doug is, and you're not somebody that's had a blog on topics like this for a long time, but you're somebody that's actively investing. Are you concerned about active versus passive?
I choose Coke. Or Pepsi? I don't know. What was the question again? Is this the Pepsi? I thought this was the Pepsi challenge. I actually, so as a federal government employee, I let the TSP do my work. I trust it to get me where I need to go in the next, what do I have, like 12 years left until I retire. But there are people that actively trade the TSP. There's a whole group dedicated to it. And they tell you what funds to switch in and out of. I'm not doing that. I've got parties to attend and I have, you know, TV to watch. Who has time to do that every single, you know, month or week? Like they even sometimes daily change their allocations. And me, I just have the L whatever target date fund. And then I just log in to check the balance and my ROR, my personal rate of return. And then I sleep well at night.
And those are passively managed funds that you're in the thrift savings plan.
Who knew?
You do know. Len, active versus passive in your personal life, do you use an active strategy or a passive or a combination of both?
I use a combination of both. And I, before I go further on that, I was shocked that it only recently the passive overcame the active. I mean, that to me, I thought passive surpassed active a long time ago. I'm just shocked it has taken this long for the passive to surpass the active. But I do a mix. I tend to use the active managed funds, and I don't do it. I mean, managers do it for a certain sector that I invest in that I am not an expert in by any means. And so I prefer to let an expert actually manage those funds for me. But the index funds I do myself because they're so broad. It doesn't take as much effort or research on my part to, so I feel safer with the passive funds. But like I said, if there's something that you're not, if you're in a very narrow niche as in certain areas, I think it's to your benefit to go with the actively managed fund. Give it to professionals who know the sector that you want to invest in.
I find that interesting as a subtopic, why you would have that narrow sector in the first place, but that's a whole different discussion. But Doug, I came to you last for a reason. I wanted to, Crystal doesn't do this professionally. Mm-hmm. Len does it, but is covering a lot of other things, consumer finance. You're talking about this kind of stuff every day with clients.
Yeah.
I think Len brings up a great point. In our world, right, financial media world, for the past 10 to 15 years, it seems like this is a ship that sailed a long time ago. Why is it 2024 and we're finally getting to this point?
Yeah, because the actively managed world and mutual fund world has been so dominant and so huge. It doesn't surprise me. It doesn't surprise me it took this long. I agree with the article that, you know, the inevitability of getting to this point was on the horizon. The popularity of passive investments and index funds has been growing and growing to the point of, you know, some hyperbolic move into where we are right now. But don't sleep on just how absolutely massive and also the start that actively managed funds have had. They've been around a long time. I mean, go back decades upon decades. I would marvel in how, from a relative standpoint, how quickly it actually has taken over, given it's really been since the 90s since we've really seen ETFs and index funds become popular. So it's had a huge head start. The flows into active management have been large. And also, don't forget, you got very large financial institutions pushing these products that charge a higher expense. Who's a Munger? Like, show me the incentive, right? So the incentive for ironically, the Wells Fargo of the world, pick any institution, really. You know, when you look at the expense ratio and what they take on actively managed funds versus their passive counterparts, I mean, they're in the business of making money, guys. So That's what they want to see their wholesalers put in the hands of investors and advisors. But performance is an interesting thing. You know, when you can't beat the market consistently, which really no one can do. And I know there's exceptions, of course, but no one can consistently beat the market. And you're going to ask yourself, why am I paying 50 basis points or 100 or 200 basis points over what I could get out of a passive strategy? I'm just not going to do it. So there obviously was a flippening there. And access to information, you know, and the internet and being able to actually see this stuff as a layperson kind of has taken over. There's my answer.
No, and there's a ton to unpack there. The first one, I thought that I didn't do at the beginning. We probably should have done, Doug, and I'll stick with you for a second. There's a percentage of our stacker universe that's like, I don't even know the difference between passive and active. Like, what the hell are you even talking about? Why is this a deal? Can you explain what's a passive investment versus an active investment?
Yeah, sure. So let's go the other way around. An active investment would be a manager, someone who's in charge of running a particular portfolio, attempting to do one thing, beat the market. They're trying to trade, get in and out of various positions and companies. Usually there's an objective here, like we're going only to invest in large US companies and try and perform as best as they can and typically beat, in that case, something like the S&P 500. So you're paying a manager to try and beat the market. That's the most simplistic version of that. Whereas passive is the exact opposite here. You're not trying to beat anything. You're just trying to participate in the market. So if the objective was to invest in the largest US companies out there, you would simply go buy the S&P 500. Every major asset manager and fund provider has an S&P 500 fund you can invest in. You're essentially paying a very nominal fee for that. In some cases, no fee. There was just recently, a few years ago, Fidelity rolled out their zero, absolutely cost-free suite of index funds. So there's your active versus passive explanation or 101 explainer.
Thank you so much for that. And by the way, just one thing on my end, because I know it's going to come up later. Some of these actively managed funds, Doug, are not trying to beat a market. They're trying to achieve just a very concrete result. They just have this is what I'm trying to achieve. And we're going to go get that. Like, I don't know, somebody showed me one of these crappy long short funds last week. And I wanted to strangle the person that owned it. Because I couldn't figure out why they own that. But yeah, usually we're trying to beat up on a market, which brings up this next point. And I want to pivot from, and I'll link to all of these in our show notes page, stackers at stackingbenjamins.com. You truly don't need to read these pieces. In fact, this next piece, our panel has from Investment News, and Investment News is an industry rag for investment advisors. They had a question that I just saw, and it's perfect timing for this discussion. How much room is there for active management, they ask? And what's interesting to me is they say that exchange-traded funds are outselling mutual funds right now. Lots of money coming out of actively managed mutual funds. When it comes to advisors, 40% of advisors, which is a huge change from 5 years ago, are looking at passive-only strategies. And I'm wondering, Doug, and again, I'm going to start with you this time and we'll go backwards, but why are advisors so slow to adopt a passive strategy when, you know, to our points earlier, it appears that passive seems to be where the ball's headed?
Yeah, there's a number of reasons why that could be. I guess some of the more benign reasons are what their clients are currently positioned in. I mean, you can go back far enough to find plenty of advisors still operating under like this old brokerage model where what they've put their clients in are loaded mutual funds, various share classes, and the cost of switching and realizing capital gains or the rights of accumulation. So the more you buy of these funds, the cheaper it has become to purchase them. They might just be locked in here. And trying to find a cost-justified solution to get out of those active strategies into passive strategies might not be worth the tax bite, might not be worth the accumulation that they have.
That makes sense to me.
Yeah, but that's a very how the sausage is made look inside the industry, and it's a good point. The other thing could be, again, incentives. I mean, I'll get really under the hood here. You have relationships between financial advisors and asset management shops and wholesalers and actual loyalty. And you'll read this in ADVs, you'll see that there are various incentives between broker dealers and mutual fund companies to use particular products. Not necessarily the best look in some cases when you really look at conflicts of interest here. You know, not every financial advisor is a fiduciary And I would argue most aren't. And that's perhaps an issue as to why you don't see this rapid adoption into passive strategies. Those are probably, in my mind, the two biggest reasons why you don't see that happening. So legacy business and incentives, you know, that aren't the incentives for the client, you know, that are incentives for either a broker dealer or an advisor in the relationship that they have with a various fund company. Again, one a little bit more benign than the other here.
Sure.
You know, but, you know, to talk my own book, I'm doing this like, look, if we can't beat the market, what my shop, it's probably 95 to 99% passive, right? I just look at the statistics. If we can't consistently beat benchmarks, if managers are historically underperforming, why on earth would we want to increase our expense budget, you know, for a client on something that traditionally can't be won, right? We'd want to save them that. I don't have any incentive to do anything but the right thing. It doesn't affect my compensation or scorecard. And that's how you have fee-only fiduciary advisors probably being the ones that are 9 out of 10 times going to be running mostly passive portfolios.
It's actually funny. This piece even dives into that, Doug, that says that as more advisors leave big firms to go to be independent advisors, more money goes passive because, to your point, they don't care anymore. Those relationships don't, you know, aren't what they're worried about. Yeah.
I mean, it gets a little dirty in that, you know, we're even talking transaction charges and ticket charges for buying and selling various instruments, right? So in this case, mutual funds or even ETFs, but mostly around the mutual fund stuff. I mean, you have advisors in these legacy businesses sticking with like these loaded chairs when it's so much more tax efficient and more efficient to trade and get in and out of stuff using ETFs. You still have, you know, most of the world using funds, you know, mutual funds and not ETFs. Forget like that there's actively managed ETFs now. Cool. Okay. There's always going to be the productification of the industry, but there you have it. I mean, I'm glad that article points that out because that's right there, the link between the two. And once you are free of the shackles of the parent company that has been overseeing you all these years, you see advisors instantly then go to ETFs and passive funds to save. And it's a great value add. Like, hi, client. Yeah. You know, where we now don't have any conflicts of interest. How would you like to save 1% in expenses? And it doesn't do any drag to, you know, the advisor's comp. They're going to be like, yeah, that's a no-brainer. Let's do that. And it actually creates a much better dynamic when it comes to the investment relationship. And in my view, a superior portfolio being built.
Joe, Doug used a new phrase there that I haven't heard before in the financial world. I might need him to clarify it a little bit. He said product defecation. what does that mean?
I think it was productification.
Yeah. I heard that incorrectly, apparently.
It's okay.
Yes. I think, Doug, that was your own shitty interpretation.
Good one.
Ba-dum-bum.
Well, but I do like that as a tool because this almost sounds like doctors pushing, you know, like prescriptions that they get a big kickback for. Like, how would a layperson protect herself from that? And I like how you said you can say, you know, how would you like to save 1% by switching to this fund? So is that what we should be asking our financial advisors? Hey, if I'm looking to save money, how do I help you help me?
Yeah, I mean, go to your financial advisor and ask, why is being positioned in actively managed mutual funds in my best interest relative to being positioned in passive funds? Can you show me any data or information to support that? Right? Mm. So instantly, how would my portfolio and whatever allocation it's in have done if we just used like core ETFs, like the plain vanilla, if we just indexed, right? Replace that large cap equity fund, you know, with a manager charging 1% trying to beat the S&P 500 and put me, what if that was in the S&P 500? Take my mid cap fund and go stick that into a mid cap core ETF. Same with small cap, same with international or emerging markets. I give some credence on bond funds. This is actually where, depending on what strategy I'm looking at, I might go and take an active stance. So like Len said, like maybe when you're getting sector specific, I mean, as an advisor, we can have preferences. Like if I'm navigating municipal bonds, right, I might want someone with actual experience in that space, particular to a state like New York municipal bonds or New Jersey. But, you know, depending on how you construct your portfolio, you could go passive there as well. It's not like there aren't any, you know, New York or New Jersey municipal bond ETFs either. Ask the advisor, hey, like, how would we have done?
I mean, it just comes down to really, if the active fund can be shown to consistently beat the index fund by, if the fee for the active fund is 1%, which is probably more than that, if it's, you know, 1.5 or 2%, you know, if it's consistently beating the index fund by 2%, then it's worth it. And now in a bull market, it's kind of hard to do that, I think. I mean, it's just so much easier and to just go with the index fund and ride the wave.
But there's also another lie that I know during my career, and it still has not been proven untrue. I was told over and over early in my career that, you know, active wins in down markets. And man, I don't know, during my career, I saw plenty of active managers getting their ass handed to them during the down market worse than the index did. So I think part of it's the way that we see active managers incentivized. They get incentivized really to not miss it by a lot. And because of that, they're not going to take big bets to try to do better by a long shot.
I think that's interesting, Joe, because just my theory, because I don't know, but my theory has always been in a bull market, an index fund makes more sense. And in a bear market, the active fund. But that's interesting to know that you've seen active managers do worse than, you know, an index fund and when the market's going down. That's kind of scary, actually. I don't think they'd be in business very long either if that kept up.
Well, they would have a lawsuit. I mean, if they don't follow the prospectus, they have a lawsuit. So the idea that a fund manager can miraculously make decisions they wouldn't make in an up market, make them differently in a down market, is baloney, because you've got all these lawyers looking over their shoulder going, I'm going to sue you. And they have. If they do anything different than what it says inside the prospectus. Now, if it goes right, is anybody really going to sue them? But if it goes wrong, and I don't think that any company, Fidelity, Vanguard, Oppenheimer, Franklin Templeton, whoever, wants that lawsuit hanging over their head.
Oh, I
think, yeah, Doug?
Yeah, so here's me playing the devil's advocate on this. If you had yourself or your advisor had put you in, you know, the appropriate risk-adjusted portfolio that was right for you and was engaging in financial planning and really did a good job of servicing you and making sure you were consistently and you are a consistent and disciplined investor over a very long period of time. And they were using actively managed funds to accomplish this. And you reached your financial goals and your portfolio compounded. And, you know, again, back to reaching your goals, you were able to, let's say, get to retirement, right? Or financial independence soundly because you followed that advice and you used those products. Are you really going to say to yourself, man, I wish I was in, you know, passive investments this whole time. And I wish my portfolio was using iShares instead of BlackRock's actively managed fund. Probably not. I think, you know, at the end of the day with personal finance, if you're able to be consistent and you're able to be disciplined and stick to your investment strategy, not shoot your own foot off when things get crazy and wild, you probably find yourself with a positive outcome. You know, then you go Monday morning quarterback the situation and be like, huh, yeah, you could always say I would have retired with $2.5 million instead of $2 million had I, you know, saved that expense. And that's real money, but that's only in hindsight. But I think where people really kind of get hosed, if you will, is when there's no planning, when there's no, you know, advice being given, and you're simply working with an investment advisor who wants to stick you in a certain family of funds to go get their commission at worst or go collect their, you know, asset management fee at best. And, you know, is kind of just trying to do their best, I guess, you know, in a way. And that's kind of loosey-goosey. That's not financial planning. That's just investment advisory. And so many advisors out there just being like, this is the way I run money. This is the way we're going to do it. These are the fund families I use. And they have great relationships. And money gets sticky, right? And it's not until the 08 and the 2020, the March 2020s, when they got a little too creative or they got a little too sexy, and they had too much, you know, in the wrong fund, that finally an investor or a client says, oh man, I need to switch this up.
I want to drive to the Northeast and give you a hug, man, because the number of people I've known that have reached their goal using suboptimal funds, but doing something beats the hell out of the number of people that have had the most tax efficient stuff and didn't do crap with it. It's so absolutely frustrating.
Yep.
Because I think we focus on the wrong thing. We don't focus on behavior. In the second half, we're going to talk actually more about some of the smoke and mirrors going on here. Is we use some of these terms like exchange traded funds to do things that maybe might or might not be good for us. And also recent Wall Street Journal pieces really call into question, is our passive investing stuff really good for us right now? But before we get to that, we have at the middle point of each show, a trivia competition. If you're new to Stacking Benjamins, between our three frequent contributors, our partner OG, who's not here this week. So Doug, you will be team OG, and Mr. Len Penzo and Paula Pant. And Crystal, you're playing team Paula Pant this week. Doug, being the only one of the three of you that hasn't done our trivia competition before, we've got good news and bad news for you, man. You want the good news or the bad news?
Bad news.
Well, the bad news is OG had like a, what, Doug, a two-year winning streak, three-year winning streak, Len?
Has he ever lost?
He had a two. Oh, no, I won the first 2 years.
Oh, yeah. Len won the first 2 years.
I'm not
going
to let you get away with that, Doug.
And then OG won the next 2 years. And but Len has four so far this year.
Wow.
OG has two. And good news for you, Crystal, Paula's not in last place. Paula, so brilliant at everything except our trivia challenge. She's usually perennially in last place. And now she's tied with OG. But because OG beat her last year, Len will guess first. Doug, you're going to guess second. And Crystal, you get to guess third.
Yay.
We mentioned a guy that wears funny hats. We have a guy with a similar name here. So we thought it was a good time for... well, some trivia that you'll understand why we did it. With Doug Bonaparte here, we had to have some Bonaparte trivia.
Oh, good.
Hey there, stackers. I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug. You'd never know it because, well, I'm so humble, but I'm actually a distant relative of Napoleon Bonaparte. Not to be confused with today's guest, Doug Bonaparte. He'll be glad to know he and I aren't related. Although, I didn't find out I was related to Napoleon Bonaparte until I was a teenager. In history class, we were studying that period in history when it was all the rage to revolt against your government, and each of us was assigned a different historical figure to do a term paper on. Since, I was the smartest kid in my class, and probably my grade, or you know, even this whole school.
Sure.
My teacher chose Napoleon for me. She wouldn't say it, but I know my teacher wanted to show me off to the principal, probably to help her get a raise. To my surprise, when my mom saw me working on it, she commented on my uncanny resemblance to Napoleon. At first, I thought she was remarking on our perfect blend of stateliness, laid-back charm, but I soon put the pieces together. He was French. Pretty sure Doug is a French name. Well, it's probably Lay Doug over there or something weird, but... and like Napoleon, I also took an ill-advised trip to Moscow that didn't turn out well, but that's a story for another day. Once you put it all together, it makes sense. So today's trivia question is, if every inch of Napoleon's height equaled a dollar, how many dollars tall was the emperor? I'll be back right after I see if any restaurants offer discounts for descendants of emperors.
Well, I'm sure there's a long list, Doug. Long list of those. So how many dollars tall, if every inch that Napoleon was equaled a dollar, how many dollars tall, Mr. Penzo?
This is another math problem. We had one. This is getting a little ridiculous here with these math problems. let's see. Napoleon?
You think it's a math-related show.
Yeah, you would think
weird.
That. You know, it's interesting. My dad, when I was growing up, he always told me he was Napoleon Bonaparte in a past life. He was serious. He really thought he was Napoleon. So but that's an aside. Let's see. One inch for every height that Napoleon is. So, gosh, I have to know how many dollars are in an inch.
Oh, no, which... no.
Wait, that's backwards.
I'm going to help you out on this one. Figure out how tall he was. If there was a buck for every inch of that height, that's how many dollars tall he is.
Come back to him.
Wait, if there was a buck for every...
Len.
What?
Inch.
Len, convert his height to inches and just say that number of dollars versus inches. And you got it.
Oh, that's it? Oh, so I don't have to know how many... Oh, that's it?
You just
that's
need it. To know
what were you thinking?
A foot. That's all.
That's right.
That's it.
That's right.
So all I have to know is how many inches tall Napoleon Bonaparte is, right?
And then just convert
that inches to dollars.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, then that's simple.
Grandpa Len gets confused.
Yeah, well, you know, that other one where you were having us calculate interest on the Gilligan's Island, that was really out there.
Oh, that's funny.
Okay, I will say, I'm going to say
$60. Doug?
Gonna go with $66.
$66. So Len thinks he's 5 feet tall. You're thinking he's 5'6".
Yeah.
Crystal?
I was trying to gather some context clues. I'm really good at context clues-ing. Because Napoleon complex, what does that mean? Does it mean short?
Short person.
Thinking it means short. Ha ha. So he had to have been shorter than 5 feet. I was going to guess the 60. So I'm going to go with 59. Aha.
Who didn't see that
Price
coming?
Price is right, Aja.
Who did not see that coming? Len, that's the gift that keeps giving when you go first.
We finally have a win.
I got sandwiched last time. That really hurt. And I did all the math in that, and I got sandwiched.
This is better. So Crystal's at 4'11". Len's at 5 feet. Doug's at 5'6". We'll see who's right. We'll be right back.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
The judge's decision was based on finding there is a
likelihood. So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
All right, Len, you kick this thing off by saying that he is $60 tall. How you feeling about that one?
You know, I don't know. I know he was short, so I you know, that's why I went with 5 feet. I don't know how short he was. Was he less than 5 feet? I guess he could be.
Why do you know? Why do you know he was short?
I just read it somewhere that he was short, and like Crystal said, that you do have the Napoleon complex. I know that has to do with being short, but I know he was very short.
Doug, having a name like Bonaparte, I'm wondering if you may have studied this topic.
When everybody and their mother asks you if you're related to Napoleon Bonaparte, you know the expression, if I had a nickel every time, I'd be a billion. Yes. Son must let know at this point. Yes. You better know a thing about Napoleon if you're going to have the last name Bonaparte. So, surprisingly, I do know quite a bit about Napoleon. And
I feel the same way, Doug.
I think we'll find out that I do. I'm confident, if not arrogant like an emperor.
Wow. We're going to call it the Bonaparte complex on this one.
I'm also 6'1", so like not anywhere near this alleged shortness that was Napoleon.
I feel the same, by the way, when people ask me if I'm related to those other Salsi highs. I'm like, yes, of course. all the other ones. Yeah. And Crystal, who is clearly the owner of Hammond, Indiana, right?
Oh, I wish. Yeah. And Crystal City here in
Crystal City,
Virginia. Yeah.
Yes. You'll take them both. Crystal, you feeling good after that confident stuff that came out of Doug's mouth?
I know, but then was it a trick? If he said he knows a lot, does Napoleon complex mean you're tall? I don't know.
Napoleon complex means you're confident.
Yeah, Doug is exuding confidence. You can see.
Being
so
short, he's tall.
Well, only one guy's got the answer. It's neighbor Doug. Doug, who's winning this thing?
Hey there, stackers. I'm natural born leader and Texarkana High School smartest freshman, Joe's mom's neighbor Doug. Bonaparte, wee mon cherry. During the height of his fame,
I think it's. Look at the spelling, Doug. I think it's ooey ooey.
It's ooey ooey. Yeah.
Lay Doug.
Yes. Ooey ooey mon cherry. Yeah, I got it. There it is.
Oh goodness.
Napoleon was known to dress in disguise and roam the streets of Paris, quizzing the electorate on what they thought of the emperor. God, I should do that. That's a great idea. Anyway. Today's question was, if every inch of Napoleon's height equaled a dollar, how many dollars tall was the emperor? The answer? With a notoriously small stature that gave birth to the term Napoleon complex, Napoleon Bonaparte was actually a little taller than the legend suggests. In France, by their measuring standards of the day, he was listed at 5'2".
Aww.
But if you convert that to the current worldwide standard, he stood at a mere 5 foot. Wait, I'm not going to give you the rest of that. I will tell you that he was 7 inches taller than what Crystal guessed. He was 6 inches taller than what Len guessed. He was 0 inches taller than what Doug Bonaparte, his namesake, guessed, because he was 5'6" tall by regular measurement standards. Jeez, he should have listened to his mother when she told him to finish his vegetables.
I thought this was the old standards. That's what you were going by, wasn't it?
Sure, Len.
You're that old to where you would have once in your life operated.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Well, they changed it when Len was 12. So,
what just dawned on me, Joe, when I heard the other Doug give his answer, was that we picked the one question that he sure as hell knew the answer to right away. Because this dude has been teased about this his entire life.
Yeah. We might have pandered to the guest a little too much.
He knows Napoleon's height more than he knows his own anniversary, probably.
Probably. No.
We won't quiz him on that. Yes, no. For Heather, she's listening. No, definitely not. Time for the second half of our discussion. By the way, congratulations, Doug. Nice job.
All right. Yeah.
Half of our discussion. He does owe you. Second half of our discussion is brought to you by depositaccounts.com. Letting you know what happens when you go to depositaccounts.com.
Yep.
Mic drop.
And that's it. Head to depositaccounts.com. Write to Len to find out exactly why you go to depositaccounts.com. I hope everybody does that. You find out that on their front page, you can compare more than 275,000 deposit rates from over 11,000 banks and credit unions, all for free. As an example, we're recording this a little early, but the average national average savings rate, 0.52%. But if you are in one of the top 1% of those 275,000 rates, 4.92, and that's down, by the way. We were just over 5 a couple weeks ago. CD rates at 5.55 if you're in the top 1%. Checking accounts, money markets, they compare all the rates, all the fees. Head to depositaccounts.com to compare, ditch, switch, and save.
I knew that.
All right. He knew all that already. So we talked about why this move to passive is not maybe taking off. And Doug gave us some good reasons. Len, I want to start with you on this one, because another piece of this is, while money's going into exchange traded funds, and you heard Doug earlier, Len, talking about how exchange traded funds more efficient than mutual funds are. They're the newer product. Clearly, mutual funds from an earlier age, exchange traded funds really meant to do in a lot of ways the same thing, but just better, right? Because more modern way to diversify. But a piece of this says there's also a bunch of money going into actively traded exchange traded funds, which makes me believe, Len, that maybe some of the stuff Doug's talking about around relationships and around higher fees, like maybe we can disguise that by just telling you over and over, Mr. Penzo, that you've got an exchange traded fund, you should be happy, because that's where the world's going.
Well, I guess, but you know what? What comes out to me at the end of the day is what the results are, right? I mean, we can make claims which one's better, but you don't know until you've held that fund for a year and you've seen the performance, maybe for a couple of years, give it a little extra time. But I mean, the results speak for themselves. So who's to say what's better except you and what you invest in and what your performance is? And I would react accordingly based on your results. Everybody's different. Everybody's investing in different things and different mixes and different allocations for their portfolio. So it's, everything's going to be different. There's no right answer. It's, you have to look at your own results, your own investment results, evaluate those results, and then react accordingly to that.
That's spoken like an engineer, Len, as if you might have played one of those for a while. Crystal, though, while I agree, there's probably no right one-size-fits-all answer. There are wrong answers. And I think what we see sometimes are people pretending they're advisors who are really salespeople who hide behind some of these sexy terms, right? They have maybe a term where they say one thing and they mean something else. I'm wondering if you have maybe been caught up before in some of these mind games that salespeople play.
Well, funny story about real estate. We had a friend who we got invited to dinner to hear a spiel. Yeah, I think we've all been here. You know where I'm going with this. And this, I'm not going to call him an idiot. You know, he or she may be listening, but they said, yeah, I'm going to dabble into real estate. I'm going to buy me a timeshare. And I'm like, that's not real estate. And so there are people who think getting a timeshare is, you know, their entry, their low barrier entry into real estate investing. And that's one of the biggest myths there is. But at least I got free dinner.
But they don't even always call it a timeshare, Crystal. Oh. If they don't want you to your timeshare, they'll say fractional ownership program.
Right. Yep. And see, buzzwords. And then he also didn't understand much. So we know our friends, bless their hearts. And when they're using terminology that you know they don't understand, you just go for your free dinner, have seconds if they'll let you, have a Ziploc bag to take leftovers, and get out of there with your pocketbook intact.
Len, this kind of feels to me like a LenPenzo.com piece, like top 10 buzzwords made to confuse you. Are there any times, Len, that you've either been caught up in this or had somebody try to pull the wool over your eyes with some of this verbiage?
Well, let's see. One I did. Okay. So once I did get caught up in something, I got caught up in the Amway. Somebody when I was younger got me to an Amway. It's not a convention. I guess it's you go to the hotel and they've rented a conference room and they have people coming in with their testimonials and how they're making all the money. And I, at the time when I was young, I was like, hey, this is kind of cool. I can make money. But the more I thought about it, you know, I decided not to do it. But what was that? Multi-level marketing, I guess they call it, right? Or something like that. So kind of just a fancy word for pyramid scheme. I did do a timeshare. I went to a timeshare presentation once. I did it willingly, knowing that I wasn't going to buy it because they were offering me...
You were getting a free trip.
No, well, close. They were offering me like 50,000 points for... This was for a hotel chain. And they were offering me 50,000 points on top of my hotel points. So I said, hey, I'll go and sit for an hour and a half and listen for 50. So I did it willingly, knowing that I wasn't going to do it. But let me tell you, they fought hard. I mean... It was not a pleasant experience for me at the end before they let me walk out of that place. Even though I was steadfast, no, they were pushing me hard and kind of giving me the guilt trip. Yeah. Yes, I did have to earn it. I wouldn't do it again, actually, to be honest with you. It wasn't worth it.
But I think of things like, lifetime guaranteed income, when they're really saying annuity. And I know sometimes annuities get a really bad rap when it truly is annuities with a lot of bells and whistles that are a problem. I think sometimes for longevity, it can be great, but they just won't say the word. Or, wealth without Wall Street. I like that one, where you bank on yourself, which is I'm going to buy a whole life insurance policy, right? Is truly what they're saying in that piece. I get frustrated with all this, Doug. I'm going to come back to you because a piece in the Wall Street Journal by Jason Zweig talking about how NVIDIA is on a tear. Just on a total tear and making tons of money. In fact, what's funny is that I love this piece. He says, if you invested $1,000 in NVIDIA at the beginning of this year, it'd be worth more than $75 million right now. And then he says, I'm kidding, of course, but it feels that way, right? Yeah. It feels like I'm missing out on these things. But there is a problem here, Doug, which is when we look at things like the S&P 500, a lot of advisors will tell you don't have more than 5% of your portfolio in an individual stock. Then it becomes a little bit too risky. So you've got more than 5% of your portfolio, maybe in Microsoft, depending on what it is this comes out. Maybe in Microsoft, maybe in Apple, maybe in NVIDIA. Is indexing more risky right now than we think it is because there's a few investments at the top that are driving a lot of results?
Yeah, that's a really good question. But let's reframe it. If you're going to be investing for a long period of time, over a multi-decade period, we can go back and see who the top components have been in the S&P 500. And it hasn't been NVIDIA. NVIDIA has just recently made its way to the top, having gone super parabolic here. I think it's the fifth or sixth largest component now. Microsoft's been in the mix. Apple's been in the mix. But it's not to say they're going to stay there in the top. Now, having said that, these multi-trillion dollar companies now or trillion plus companies seem to be way, way far ahead of other components in there. And they look like they might have some staying power here. But I really don't view, having a cap weighted index as that much riskier. By the way, how would you all right. So let's say you went for an equal cap weighted, S&P 500 fund, which are you happy right now relative to, whether or not you had just bought the S&P 500? Probably not. You maybe would have been happy or in 2022 in a bad year, right? We can fact check me on that one. I'm pretty sure the equal weighted index did better, but
I would think so.
Yeah, I would think so too. But no, I just really don't think if you're holding for a long period of time, you know, things change. This is dynamic. You might be indexing today, but like the 500 shifts around quite frequently. So in 10 years from now or in 15 years from now, who are the top components going to be?
Just the components also, Doug. I mean, like if you look at the Dow, right? If you go back 50 years, the Dow 50 years ago, I don't know what it is, but I'll bet you more than half the components of the Dow today were not in the Dow 50 years ago.
Look at GE as like a perennial example of this. Like, when's the last time you even heard GE as like any kind of performer here like the IBMs of the world? These used to be the bellwethers, you know, these were the bells of the ball. And now, you know, they're hardly mentioned at all. You have Apple, Microsoft, Meta.
Well, some companies are gone, right? Wasn't Sears a component of the Dow at one time? Sears Roebuck, maybe?
I'm sure it must have been.
And it's, what, that company's gone, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
Crystal, during this discussion, I'm thinking about just the fact of, should we know a little more about what's under the hood, or should we just let it work its magic? And I'm kind of two minds here. I mean, on one hand, I feel like if you look under the hood and you raise the alarm bell like I just did, you might jump off a strategy that works. And to Doug's point and Len's point, things change over time. And if you just stick with the index, it'll do what the index does. But when you don't know you're taking a certain amount of risk, that also kind of bothers me, as it does another Wall Street Journal piece I'll link to here by Spencer Jacob, talks about how, you know, your average target date fund investor has no idea what they're invested in. They get put in automatically by their company. And when they get to retirement, they have no strategy of what to do with it once they are trying to take income from it. I know if you're using the L fund, you're using a lifestyle type fund. I mean, does that make you think maybe I should look under the hood more?
Well, they do have options, because I do remember one year saying, okay, I'm going to take it into my own hands. And I tanked. And I was like, see, I just should have kept it where it was and not touched anything.
Lesson.
And they do these, you know, retirement seminars after you've been in the office for 15 years. You get to attend this seminar. But there's a lot to say about how knowledgeable the people that are leading these seminars. But one of the key things, like Doug said before about the 08s, you know, in certain years when people were in these target date funds and they had no business in those funds. So it does pay to have your own education, because if I'm 5 years out of retirement, I don't care how well the stock market is doing. Yeah. I should not have, you know, my money in stocks. My retirement, my nest egg, I should not have that in stocks. And
you mean individual stocks?
Blind, right? Yeah, but even the fund, because there's a G fund that's only the bonds, government bonds. So it gradually gets you into the G fund. But I don't want to depend on that fund. I want to make sure that it's happening. I don't want to blindly trust it. And that's what we're doing with our target date funds. So
see,
I'm going to keep
it
in there.
I don't want a lot of my money in the G fund ever.
No.
But that's a different different day.
But close to retirement, if you're 5 years out, you want, you know, no news is good news kind of investment. That's my understanding. And that's what I learned, not from being in my company offered retirement account. That's, you know, from listening to these kind of podcasts and, you know, being in the personal finance space. That's how I know better.
Well, Len, and where do you come down? I mean, Crystal says we should not really look under the hood as much as kind of know what's going on in the zeitgeist. How about for you?
Zeitgeist.
Well, I was just looking at some numbers here in the investing world. I do index funds. I do actively managed funds, and I dabble around myself where I do my own management of individual stocks. So I'm going to give you the sector that I was talking about before. It's very risky. The reason I go into the actively managed fund is because it's extremely risky. It's very technical. I don't know anything about it. It's the mining sector. It's very risky. You can lose a lot of money very fast if you don't know what you're doing. So that's why I have an actively managed fund. So I'm going to give you right now my year-to-date results for my index fund that I have, my actively managed fund, and me playing with 10% of the funds that I've put into the actively managed funds. But it's like me playing manager. And this is why I don't do this. I'm down 35% myself picking individual stocks this year. Yikes. I'm down 35%. You imagine
buy and low. Well,
that's right. But I mean, do you imagine if I put my whole portfolio and I decided to do
lose a third
of it? Actively managed fund. And right now the mining sector has been beat up. It is as low as it's ever. It's just nobody wants it. It's unloved. The actively managed fund is down 20%. This is a manager picking individual stocks doing this. And I'm paying
in the mining sector.
In the mining. And I'm paying him 1% per year on a pretty good chunk of change, okay? Which ain't now since it's down 20%. And then the index fund, which I do myself, it's just an index fund that I in the mining sector. That's down 10%. So those are your numbers, basically. Minus 10, minus 20, minus 35. The index fund, even in the down market, is better than the active manager. And it's way better than what I was doing playing investment cowboy. Mm. So there you go. I've just invalidated my own thoughts on, remember I said I thought in the bear market the index fund would not.
And
it's short. This is only in a 3-month period, 4-month period. But there you go.
And I've heard that for a long time, Len, and it plays out much more like you're talking about than we think it does over and over and over. I mean, this myth that the active management's going to win in a down year is difficult. Doug, where do you come down between your clients looking under the hood and or just knowing the overall strategy?
Yeah, like I said earlier, we're primarily a passive shop. I really, again, look at the statistics. I don't believe active management is going to outperform passive strategies and the index over the long term. I want to compress fees as much as possible. I just don't think that's where I want to, my clients spending their money and their expense. I'd rather them get good financial advice and financial planning from us and learn all the ways that they can be consistent and disciplined when it comes to investing. You know, when things get crazy, both good and bad, that's really where we shine as professionals. We're professional expectation setters. We have to make sure that our clients don't make mistakes due to their own behavior. That's really where we have the most value. So I just never believe that picking stocks or guessing which sectors or which slant, whether it's value versus growth, is going to do the best. I just don't think that's a winning game to play when I do know that controlling behavior over the long term is a winning game here. And again, like I said earlier, that's not to say there aren't areas. I do believe in less efficient markets, a professional who really understands the space. You know, I think they can do a good job there. If you have hundreds to thousands of analysts covering large cap stocks or a specific sector, what are the odds, one of them is going to be like, I know something all the others don't, probably not great. What if there's only 6, 7, 8, a couple dozen people covering a specific space? There it seems to me a little more likely that one might be doing a little bit better research than the other. So there could be an edge there. But this is really few and far between, and it's very, very client specific with how we think about actually using active management. And by the way, there's always a little bit of active management going on even when you're using passive investments. You still need to create an allocation particular, that's designed around that client. I'll give you a great example. I took the Fed at their word before they started increasing rates that they were going to raise rates, right? You hear the expression, don't fight the Fed. So we look to clients, particularly in this case, older clients who have more exposure to fixed income, to bonds, and you say to yourself, if you're passively investing in, let's say, AGG or just the Barclays Aggregate or the U.S. Bond Index, and you got the Fed saying, we're going to raise rates consistently to fight inflation, you're looking at your bond portfolio, you're like, I'm pretty long duration here. That's the measure of the sensitivity of interest rates to bond prices. And you need to know, I'm getting technical here, but you need to know it's an inverse relationship, right? If you're literally hearing the chairman say we're going to raise rates and you're long on bonds, you got long duration, maybe you make an adjustment there. All right. Maybe you go shorter duration and you say, or you move a portion of that bond portfolio to something short. We took the Fed at their word and it paid off. Mm-hmm. But here's the thing about active management. It's not that you got to be right once. You got to be right twice.
Right. Because then you got to move. You got to move back now.
You got to move back. And luckily, we did well enough on that to be perhaps early in getting back. You gave yourself a greater margin to get it right twice. And it's not very comfortable stuff for someone who's as passive as me, but
there are times in which your research, knowledge, and understanding of things come into play and you make a call like that. And luckily, you know, for the clients of the firm, it worked out well. And the Fed ended up raising, what, 11 consecutive times there. So if you were if you were long bonds, you got caught up in 2022 with the worst year for fixed income in a century.
I love that, because there were maybe, in my 16-year career, there were maybe, I'm going to say five times, Doug, that I was like, this just seems to be the world's most obvious call. And then you really do have to question yourself, because to your point, it's not about being right that first time. It is. Are we willing to stake, you know, our clients' money, not even our money on it? And so, but think about how rare that is. If it's that few times over that long of a period,
super rare. When it was the worst bond market in a century, and that's not hyperbole. That's the real statistic. So yeah, that's not going to come around very often, if at all. We'll be lucky to see something like that, you know, a handful of times in our life.
Yeah, amen. I think it's a great place to leave it, guys. We'll link to all these pieces on our show notes at stackingbenjamins.com. Great discussion about active versus passive investing. And I think for people that don't know a lot about this, I think it's a great primer to begin digging in more. Let's find out what's happening where each of you are, and we'll have our guest of honor go last. Let's start with my co-host over on Stacking Deeds. Crystal, we've had some fun over there lately. Can you want to go over a guest or two that we're going to be shining a light on?
Coming up is Dave Linegar. He goes over the basics, but I really, really love how he broke it down. Like he goes into like contractors. He goes into like, there's some lines that I plan on using in my going forwards with my big construction project. So I love a lot of the tips that he gave, the systems. Like, I'm serious. Like, I can't wait to put all this into play. I'm just waiting on zoning. Can someone speed up the zoning office in Chicago, please?
If we could get somebody in that zoning department to move on crystals.
Ken Griffin couldn't even get their zoning department to move. He left town. I don't think you're going to do it, Crystal.
Well, she's Crystal Hammond. Come on.
True. Yeah, exactly.
There's that. And that's on our Stacking Deeds podcast. We're also talking to the Crickies, who are a husband and wife team, who do Airbnbs. They do short-term rentals. So short-term rental landscape changing. So for people wanting more on that, we're talking about that. Mr. Penzo, what's happening at LynnPenzo.com?
You know, this week, a reminder, every weekend on Saturdays, we do our weekly financial roundup. It's more macroeconomics, but it's always the best in the news of the week. The best tweets that I find and the best memes that are related. And it's a fun little time. I will say, Doug, I actually featured one of your great tweets in last week's edition. I'll just read it here because I thought it was so clever.
Good.
It's he said, due to inflation, February now has 29 days. I thought that was fantastic. So we put that in there. And one of his followers said, March is going to be 45 days long if we don't get this figured out. So anyways, that's the kind of stuff you get. But good stuff from Doug. Excellent follow, by the way,
Doug. Yeah, he's funny. Yeah, agree. He's
funny.
Thanks,
guys.
Doug, thank you so much for... Thank you for joining us, man. It's been too long, but what are you guys working on? People want to get a hold of you. How do they find you besides following your cleverness on Twitter/X?
Yeah. It's always a good time over on X, the platform formerly known as Twitter. Same handle all over the place. You can follow me anywhere you like, really. It's at Doug Bonaparte. And when you do follow me, you'll get that sweet link tree in the bio, and you can find your way to all the cool stuff we're working on. The main project right now is my wife and I are working on our second book.
Cool.
Yeah. Guys, you know, I almost tongue in cheek say, don't write a book. No, seriously, it's a fantastic project. We're writing about love and money and the power dynamics between couples when it comes to this topic, something that really hasn't been written before. Our goal is to be able to have couples literally be able to communicate around money. We don't do a good job at that because it's so much about our identity. So we're working on that. We're not going to see that till late 2025 at the rate we're going here. But in the meantime, if you like talking about things having to do with relationship and money, we have an awesome newsletter called The Joint Account, which every week we've been writing about. I'll handle Q&A, reader questions about how to handle certain things. And Heather, the brilliant writer she is going deep on these concepts around relationships and money. That's over on Beehive. Make sure you subscribe.
I thought the joint account was about marijuana this whole time.
That's my Substack, not my Beehive.
Turns out I was completely wrong. We'll link to that in our show notes page. Guys, thanks all three of you for joining us. This was a great discussion. Doug, what should be on our to-do list today, man?
So what's stacked up on our to-do list for today? First, take some advice from our guest, Doug Bonaparte. Maybe some of the push toward actively managed ETFs is because the large institutions offering them are making money from management fees. If your advisor is recommending you add one to your portfolio, ask them, why is being positioned in actively managed funds in my best interest? Second, take a note from Len Penzo. If you're comparing an active ETF to a passive ETF, take a look at the historical performance. While past performance doesn't indicate future success, yada, 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 it's a decent clue to whether or not the management fees are worth it. But what's the biggest to-do? I'm going to open an Ancestry.com account so I can find out what other famous French people I'm related to. Based on personality alone, I bet it's either like Joan of Arc or Pepe Le Pew, or maybe that great French writer named, what was it, Solitaire, something like that? Thanks to Doug Bonaparte for joining us today. You can find more about Doug at bonafidewealth.com. We'll also include links in our show notes at stackingbenjamins.com. Thanks to Crystal Hammond for hanging out with us today. You'll find her fabulous podcast, Stacking Deeds, wherever you listen to finer podcasts. And thanks to Len Penzo for joining us today. You can find Len at lenpenzo.com/mining, maybe? This show is the property of SB Podcasts, LLC, copyright 2024, and is created by Joe Salcihi. Our producer is Karen Repine. This show is written by Lisa Curry, who's also the host of the Long Story Long podcast, with help from me, Joe, Kate Youngkin, Karen Repine, and Doc G from the Earn and Invest podcast. Kevin Bailey helps us take a deeper dive into all the topics covered on each episode in our newsletter called The 201. You'll find the 411 on all things money at The 201. Just visit stackingbenjamins.com/201. Wonder how beautiful we all are? Of course you do, but you'll never know if you don't check out our YouTube version of the show, engineered by Tina Eichenberg. Then you'll see once and for all that I'm the best thing going for this podcast. Once we bottle up all this goodness, we ship it to our engineer, the amazing Steve Stewart. Steve helps the rest of our team sound nearly as good as I do right now. Want to chat with friends about the show later? Mom's friend Gertrude and Julia Garib are our social media coordinators, and Gertrude is the room mother in our Facebook group called The Basement. So say hello when you see us posting online. To join all the basement fun with other stackers, type stackingbenjamins.com/basement. For more interactive fun, join us on Instagram every Tuesday and Thursday for our Instagram Lives. Kate Youngkin and Joe host those weekly. Not only should you not take advice from these nerds, don't take advice from people you don't know. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any financial decisions, speak with a real financial advisor. I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, and we'll see you next time back here at the Stacking Benjamin Show.